From KUAZ News in Tucson, I'm Julie Burock, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Arizona is in the midst of a record-breaking drought, causing the wildfire danger in the state to be considered extreme. Today, part two of Robert Rappaport's series on the drought. According to a new report released this week by the Pew Hispanic Center, it's estimated that the number of illegal immigrants in the United States has grown to as high as 12 million. This morning, part one in a series of features on migration and the town of Altar, Sonora, Mexico, a major staging area for migrants crossing into the United States. Plus, the commentary of Baxter Black. Those stories and more are coming up, but first. Wildfire danger in Arizona is extreme right now, and a big reason for that is the dry winter we're having. That's the focus of KUAZ's Robert Rappaport's second segment of a three-part series on the drought.
With southern Arizona about to set a record for the driest winter ever, coupled with a 10-year drought, conditions for wildfire are ripe in the Tucson area. Coronado National Forest fire prevention tech and firefighter Dwayne Brown says the forest and the land around it is a tinderbox waiting to burn. He demonstrated that fact to me during a recent interview at Sabino Canyon.
The conditions that we're seeing around us and in the whole area here in southern Arizona are extremely dry, drier, in fact, than we have ever seen before. And when I say ever seen before, I'm including the dry periods just before the monsoons. This is just off our scale. Let's walk a bit and see what we can find here. We'll walk in a ways and see. We're dealing in an area here that has mesquite and some Palo Verde, a little bit of grass, a little bit of oak. And as we walk along, you can just hear how extremely dry this is. Let me pick a piece here. Some of this grass. And break this up, and it's just tinder. It's completely dry. There's no evidence of any moisture whatsoever in this. It's so dry that it would just almost immediately disappear in fire because of the fact that there's no moisture in it. As we move along, here's some mesquite, and we can break off a piece, and it's just easily broken. There's no indication of any moisture whatsoever.
The crackling of dead brush you heard proves Brown's point, and a special machine confirms it.
Which is basically a glorified oven. The fuel is weighed, and then it is cooked at a predetermined temperature for a period of time, and then it's weighed again. And the moisture, of course, is removed by the heat. So by comparing the preheated weight to the after-heated weight, we can determine how much moisture was in the fuel itself. The readings on this machine are set up to go from 0 to 300 on a scale. And we'd like to see the readings in the area of 125 through 150, 175. It varies. And right now, the readings that we're picking up and have been for a number of weeks are in the area of 50. We consider 50 to be dead, extremely stressed, or dying. So the readings that I'm getting continually now on Manzanita shows that these plants are technically dead, although they most likely would come back if there were some moisture. They're right in that gray area where they are about to die. And we have never seen these figures this low at any time in southern Arizona. This is new ground. This is uncharted territory. And for this reason, we are extremely cognizant of the fact that fire behavior could be catastrophic. With a little bit of wind, and if we had a start with the lack of moisture in the fuels, the fire could move very rapidly, grow very large, very quickly. This is causing us enough concern to where we're actually bringing engines in from other states to augment the resources that we have here on hand, so that if there were a start, we would have sufficient manpower and equipment right on hand to be able to deal with it.
Fire prevention tech Dwayne Brown says Mount Lemmon is faring better, but that's not saying much.
The readings we're getting up there are a little bit more moist, but not significantly. We still have extremely dry conditions up there. The conditions up there are such that if there were to be a start, we could expect extreme fire behavior, even with the fact that it's a little wetter and a little bit cooler. It's still a tinderbox, and it's ready to go.
While rebuilding continues on Summerhaven following the devastating Aspen Fire, which destroyed about 340 homes and businesses in June 2003, it's possible some of the area atop Mount Lemmon could burn again in the worst-case scenario. Brown says he's worried about that.
We're really concerned now because things are so dry. We do not want a re-happening. We don't want these fires or fires like the Bullock and the Aspen to start up again. There's plenty of fuel out here that has not yet been burned, even though portions have been. There's still lots available. And we're extremely concerned and would like to ask the public as they come out and enjoy the forest, as they go on their camping trips and their picnics, to do that which is right, to enjoy themselves, but also to be cognizant of the extreme fire danger and the fact that it is so dry.
Since the conditions are so dry right now in southern Arizona, the Coronado National Forest already has been bringing in fire crews from other states to learn the area in case they're needed when fires break out. Bill Meyer is the engine boss from Wyoming 631, a three-person Type 6 wildland fire engine crew from western Wyoming. He says he's surprised at how dry the vegetation is.
This is a different climate altogether than what I'm used to, but it's just amazing to me how dry it is. You know, every day, like I said, we monitor the weather and fuel samples, and, you know, I've never even seen, you know, relative humidities as low as it is here, and the moisture level in the fuels as low as they are here. So this is new to me.
Fellow firefighter Adam Cook says his experience here is not only training, but educating.
Learn, drive some of the roads, meet some of the people out recreating, talk with them a little bit, check campfires, let the public know how dry it is when we are talking to them. And, you know, you can tell just by driving up and down the roads and how much dust is behind you, how dry it is and how long it's been since they've had precip. So it's just informing the public of that is a big part of it.
For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Robert Rappaport.
Next week, Robert concludes his report on the drought, focusing on the long-term effects of below-normal precipitation. Since there's been no lightning to speak of, the fires we've already experienced this year have been human-caused. As Robert prepared his series on the drought, he took a few moments to have firefighters Bill Meyer and Dwayne Brown demonstrate the proper techniques for building and extinguishing a campfire.
If you look, you know, around our campfire ring, we cleared out, you know, all the fuels and stuff around it, so there's nothing right adjacent to our fire ring. You know, there's no grass or other fuels that could ignite easily if a spark did get outside the ring. And then another thing we did here, too, is we actually wetted the area down around the fire ring a little bit just so that there was less chance of a spark starting a fire.
So say we're done with the fire right now, which is burning quite well. What is the proper way you can describe to put this out?
Well, what we'll do first is we actually have our fire hose here. So we'll actually spray down the fire with a little bit of water. You know, generally if somebody's out camping, maybe they have a bucket, you know, a 5-gallon bucket or something with them to dump on the fire first. But even though the flames would go away, then what you want to do, we have some of our fire tools here. You want to mix up the fuel with the water as well as the ground. You almost want to make kind of like a mud pie. Even though you spray water on it, you don't see flames. There can still be residual heat in the fuel and the ground that once you walk away, it could reignite and start burning.
Okay, Bill, why don't you go for it and we'll capture some of the sounds of that.
Okay, sounds good.
Now, the average person won't have fire tools and a fire hose with them, so what should they be doing at this point where you're hitting it with shovels?
They could be using a stick. A lot of people, they might have a shovel, maybe a small camp shovel with them when they're out camping. That would work very well for mixing it up.
Now, what should the ground look like to know that you properly have the fire out?
Well, it definitely should look wet, but it also should look stirred up. If you just dump the water on the fire without stirring it, there's a really high potential for heat being trapped underneath the water, and once the water evaporates, then it could start burning again.
Now, is this one safely out?
Yeah, I think so. The next thing we'll do is we'll just feel down there with our hands a little bit just to make sure that there's no hot spots. That's a good rule of thumb. If you can touch it with your hand, you know it's safe. But you'll notice we start with the backside of our hands first just to, you know, not touching the fuel, just to see if you can feel any heat coming off. Because obviously you wouldn't want to burn yourself by just going in there and grabbing if there was something hot.
Okay. Dwayne Brown, when is it safe to leave this fire?
Well, I would ask that when they're completely have their camp broken down, everything's loaded on the vehicle and they're ready to head out or ready to head down the trail, that they make a last check and actually, once again, feel and make sure there's no temperature in there. It should be the last thing they do as they leave the camp, is to make certain that that fire is dead out, because we certainly can't take a chance with the conditions as they are now.
Up next on Arizona Spotlight, a feature story on migration in the town of Altar, Sonora, Mexico. It's a staging area for migrants crossing the Arizona-Mexico border. That story when we continue with Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. As the debate over what to do about illegal immigration continues on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., hundreds of migrants are gathering in the small community of Altar, Sonora, Mexico, to prepare for their trek across the U.S.-Mexico border. With days that aren't too hot and nights that aren't too cold, March is a busy time of year for migrants attempting to cross. I recently visited Altar as the men and women were preparing for their journey. Altar, Sonora is located 60 miles from the Arizona border. Driving south on the highway into Mexico, I'm surrounded by rolling hills and mountains. Peering out the window of the bus, a depiction of Our Lady of Guadalupe is inscribed on a mountain wall. The image is a foreshadowing of what lies ahead. Our Lady of Guadalupe is the patron saint of Mexico. The parish church in Altar is named for her and rests in the middle of the town square. Entering the town, the streets are packed with vendors and small businesses selling backpacks, hats, coats, and water jugs. Migrants gather in the town square. They're awaiting buses to take them to nearby Sasabe, where they will continue their journey into the Sonoran Desert. Migration is the business of this town. It's essentially a staging area for migrants gearing up to make the often deadly trip across the border. Altar is a migrant terminal, but it hasn't always been that way. Just a few years ago in the 1990s, Altar was a quiet little town. Now, while local townspeople quietly pray in the church, smugglers are closing deals right outside in the town plaza.
The town of Altar has really become the center of the migration that comes, the migratory flows that cross the Arizona-Sonora Desert. Because of the way the U.S. crackdown on border crossings in other parts of the U.S.-Mexico border, meaning San Diego, El Paso, South Texas, because of the way that's played out, it's essentially ended up funneling huge flows of migrants through the Arizona-Sonora border and the desert.
Erica Dahlberdeen is the Mexico Director of the Catholic Relief Services. She took me along with a group of parishioners from the Diocese of Tucson to visit the town and the nearby migrant center that provides services to the needy. She says migration has had a major impact on Altar's local economy.
Many, many businesses have grown up around providing various services to migrants, such as lodging, food, selling them supplies, transportation, and so on. It's really what's moving the local economy down.
Buses arrive daily from all over Mexico to drop migrants off in the town square. On average, 1,500 migrants pass through Altar every day. Most will stay in one of the 120 privately owned guest houses with their smugglers or coyotes for 20 to 30 pesos a night. They'll stay a minimum of 3 days before they attempt to cross the border. But for those who have no money, food, or place to sleep, the nearby migrant center is there to provide assistance. Father Prisciliano Peraza is the pastor of Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and also the director of the Centro Comunitario de Atención al Migrante y Necesidad, the community center to aid migrants and the needy. He's speaking through an interpreter.
The migration phenomenon that we're experiencing here is very complex. It's not just a question of deciding to leave my house one day and go somewhere else far away, which is really a right. We believe that all people have the right to migrate and move freely if they need to. The problem is when someone is forced to leave their home and travel to a far-off place because of need. And what makes us very sad is that it's because of economic policy that is causing so much poverty that our brothers and sisters are forced to leave their homes and migrate the way they do.
The lack of an economic policy is the overriding theme when you speak with people in the town. The increase in migration is blamed on two things. The first is the North Atlantic Free Trade Agreement, and the second, a U.S. crackdown at the border. Father Prisciliano says before NAFTA was signed, migrants would go across the border for short periods of time to work and then come back. But that's no longer the case.
But around that same time, it began to be much more difficult for people to cross the border. That's when the government began to really seal many of the crossing points. And so people would, rather than just going and staying for a little bit, would end up staying permanently in the U.S. because it was so hard to get back and forth. And then from that time on, the situation has only gotten more complex and complicated. We started to see more of a crackdown by authorities on both sides of the border, bands of much more sophisticated smugglers. And our brothers and sisters, the migrants, are increasingly exploited. Their rights are violated. They're taken advantage of.
Francisco Garcia Aten is the former mayor of Altar. He agrees that NAFTA has played a major role in the business of the town. He says Altar's main economic basis is migration, also because of a lack of investment in the town.
And what we're seeing in the many, many clauses that we signed on to as part of NAFTA, that Mexico signed on to, has really created the conditions that have forced many, many more people to migrate to the United States. And that agreement, NAFTA, has also affected the agriculture and ranching activities here that were traditional mainstays of this community. So Altar is really very fortunate in that, in the absence of any other kinds of investment and with the decline of agriculture and ranching here locally, at least we got this influx of economic activity that was caused by these flows of migrants. The other surrounding areas don't have that.
Since 1994, the presence of migrants in this town has been growing steadily. Every year, new hotels and restaurants are popping up. Many townspeople have transformed their homes into guest houses for the migrants. In addition to Altar's 120 privately owned bunkhouses, there are 12 hotels and 220 private buses that operate going to Sasabe all day. There is no regulation of these services, and often migrants are charged exorbitant rates, 20 pesos for a bunk, 10 pesos to take a shower, another 10 pesos for a towel. One night in a guest house can cost a migrant 40 pesos a day. Entering Hermitage Lupita, a privately owned guest house, a small child is sleeping alone on a bunk, which is nothing more than a slab of wood with a thin layer of green carpet. She does not wake as a group of 20 file down the aisle past the kitchen. This guest house is considered one of the better ones in the town. Otherwise, the owner would not have let us in. At the center of the guest house is a courtyard with several small rooms surrounding it, all of which are packed with bunks. Several migrants are resting. They're eager to talk to us, and we speak with them while standing in a puddle on the concrete floor. One man steps forward. He doesn't offer his name, but with tears in his eyes, he's anxious to tell his story. He's a young man, mid to late 20s, dressed in dark clothing. He recently left his two small children to seek work in the United States. That same night, he will attempt for the first time to cross the border.
I'm trying to find work because where we live, there isn't any. I'm from Chiapas. We're just trying to do something good with our lives. It's very difficult at home. They've already told me it's very hard to get across. But what other choice do we have? We're going to do what we can. We're going to walk as hard as we can. You know that in Chiapas, we've been seriously affected by the hurricane. I work in the countryside, and the hurricane destroyed most of our crops. I'd like to get to Florida. I've been told you can make decent money in Florida.
On this particular day, a state human rights worker was in the guest house monitoring its conditions and visiting with the migrants. His name is René de Carmen, and he believes the United States and Mexico need to come to an agreement for the sake of both countries.
It's time for our country's governments to sit down and to hammer out some kind of an agreement that will put an end to the discrimination of migrants, to the mistreatment, and to the violation of basic rights. We need an agreement that's in the interest of both our countries, because in the end, it's in the interest of Mexico, of course, to have an outlet for their people who don't have work. But it's also in the interest of the U.S. that's benefiting greatly from the labor of these folks.
Most migrants in this house are preparing to cross the border. Some will attempt to cross in a few hours, some will attempt in a few days. They'll walk to the nearby town square, say a prayer to Our Lady of Guadalupe, board a bus, and travel the dirty, bumpy road to Sasebe. Most know the risks, but feel they have no choice but to find their way to the United States. Next week, part two of our series on migration in the town of Altar, Sonora. We'll further examine the guest houses and the local migrant center. Coming up next on Arizona Spotlight, the commentary of cowboy poet and humorist Baxter Black. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. It's time now for the commentary of cowboy poet and humorist Baxter Black. Baxter says springtime in the Rockies ain't all it's cracked up to be. Here's Jan, Feb, Mud.
March comes in like a lion and goes out like a flatbed full of wet hotel laundry. The most I can say about March is it's a month of change. If March was a person, it would be an old man. Cracked and weathered and cantankerous, occasionally bearable, but bent on maintaining his reputation for orneriness, the kind that won't turn up his hearing aid or zip his fly. In the deep South, March is pleasant. Matter of fact, they even look forward to it. But for most of cow country, the deep South might as well be on the backside of the moon. The March rain up here is not a gentle, life-giving shower from heaven to be savored and sniffed. It's more like the angels hosing out their hog confinement shed. And the gentle breezes that whisper through the Houston pine trees aren't even a distant relative to the steady, bone-chilling 20-mile-an-hour wind that whistles across eastern Idaho. Even the word march is harsh and conjures up a tough, unforgiving image. Not like light and airy April or more comfortable short February. If I was asked to rename March, I would call it Mud. January, February, Mud. Mud the 7th. The Ides of Mud. Doesn't sound much different, does it? Mud is a busy time of the year. Feedlots are full, calving is starting, and the lambing crew's still getting the jugs ready. Cowboys are still wearing their winter long johns and five-buckle overshoes. It's too soon to take the mud and snows off the pickup. The days are getting longer, but nobody knows why. The horses still have their hairy side out. It's usually the last month you can stick a tractor up to the axle. What most people do in March is look forward to April. Well, one good thing about this miserable wind is it'll help dry up the mud. Yep, we'll be able to get into the fields next month. Yeah, and the bulk of the calving will be over in 3 or 4 weeks. It seems I ought to have something good to say about March. It's good and cold, good and windy, good and long. Is that good enough? I only know one cowman who liked March. He said when it was over, at least he still wouldn't have the whole winter to go through. He was just glad it didn't come in November.
Here's KUAZ's Mark McLemore with the Arizona Spotlight Arts Calendar.
Tonight at the Berger Performing Arts Center, the quintessential voice of Brazil, Monica Salmaso, will present a show, information online at rhythmandroots.org. The Top Hat Theater Club has Garson Kanin's classic American comedy, Born Yesterday, for one more weekend, tonight, tomorrow night, at 7:30. The Etc. Late Night Series also has one more weekend of Romeo and Juliet. Their plays begin at 10:30, Friday and Saturday evening, 327-4242, for reservations. Happening on Saturday night, the OTO Dance Company will present a night of wild, crazy, ecstatic dancing at the Ort Space. That's at 7th and 7th. Saturday night is also the night for the Primavera All-Stars show at the Berger Performing Arts Center. The Tucson Jazz Society's 26th annual celebration of women begins. TucsonJazz.org has information. The Manhattan Transfer will be performing with the Tucson Symphony Orchestra. It's Saturday night only at 7:30 at the Tucson Music Hall. This weekend, the Arizona Theater Company begins a production of Sherlock Holmes' The Final Adventure at the Temple of Music and Art. 622-2823 for information. In Sierra Vista this weekend, the Circus Chimera and the Sabar Shrine Center present Alice in Wonderland. It runs all weekend with matinees Saturday and Sunday. CircusChimera.com has information.
We got an email last week which took issue with our coverage of the Tucson Rodeo. Gary Vella of the Animal Defense League wrote that our statement that police always keep protesters at bay left the impression with listeners that there have been situations where the police have had to step in and restrain protesters. According to the Tucson Police Department, animal rights protesters are always present at the rodeo, but there have been no recent incidents where protesters have misbehaved or had to be restrained in any manner. If you have comments about our program, good or bad, please send them to KUAZ.org. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood with production assistance from Ginger Duran. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. A portion of the music heard on today's program was written and performed by Calexico. Audio archives of Arizona Spotlight programs are available online at KUAZ.org. Podcasts are also available. I'm Julie Bierock.